From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a graduate of Edison Tech in Rochester headed off for college. Adam McFadden was going to major in accounting, and his career goal, one of them, was to be a controller. Now, for many of us, that seems like a haze of numbers and wonkiness, but for McFadden, it was exciting. It was just one of his goals to not only make a living, but serve his community. McFadden graduated, came back to Rochester, working as a financial analyst at Fleet's investment operation. He became a controller of a software development company. He's the executive director of Quad A for Kids. He's been the interim executive director for the Rochester Housing Authority, and he's been a member of Rochester City Council for many years now. He's also a dad of three daughters. And now McFadden would like to go to Washington. He's one of four Democrats running for the seat that was long filled by Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, who passed away recently. The primary is fast approaching, falling on Tuesday, June 26th, and we're holding a series of interviews with the candidates individually for that seat. Today we welcome Councilman Adam McFadden. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Rochester born and raised.
Absolutely.
And the best, you always say it's the best part of the city.
The 19th Ward, that's right. It is. Absolutely. Not being biased, but it is.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, and I want to go all the way back to your childhood to all the way through the issues that maybe drive this candidacy. But I've been asking all of the people who are running for this seat what it was that swung this decision for you, because you had to make it relatively quickly. And well, take me through that process.
Well, for me, WDKX ran a poll on air about who they thought should take Louise Slaughter's seat. That was on a Friday. Saturday, Joe Morelli announces that he's running. Sunday, Joe Morelli calls me and asks for my support. Monday, I'm not really thinking about this. Tuesday, I go into WDKX, and I see how large the response was in favor of me running, and I think to myself, I've really got to consider doing this because the people are telling me to do this. It wasn't a room of insiders. It wasn't my ego. It was the fact that I had a large number of people calling to the radio station basically asking me to run. And that's what swung the decision for me.
It's a big career change. And did you think about all the things you'd have to uproot and change if this happened?
Well, I had to talk to my family, specifically my daughters. My oldest daughter went to the U of R, ended up getting her master's at Texas A&M at the Bush School of Governance. She lives in Seattle. My middle daughter is a senior now, graduating from Aquinas. And my youngest daughter will be finishing eighth grade. So I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't disrupting the relationship and everything that I have with them, because I spent my last few years really building that bond with my children. I drive my daughters to school every day. I pick them up every day. So for me, that would be some interruption of that.
Now, it's one thing to hear that you've got voters in a district who want you to run. It's another to understand exactly why you think they were overwhelmingly supporting you. Why did you feel that way?
I would say of all of the people currently in this race, my track record for speaking up for people, whether it's popular or not, has been pretty consistent. I don't really care about critics. I try to do what's right based on truth.
That's the reputation you feel like
very strong
has been established with voters. Okay. And it's interesting, you say that Joe Morelli called you asking for support. What did you tell him when he called you?
I wasn't willing to give it to him at that time. It wasn't because I don't like him. We have a really good relationship. Matter of fact, I've sat down and talked to all of the opponents in this race, but because for me, this isn't going to be about mudslinging or trying to bash each other. I think all of the people are great people individually, but I wasn't there. I just thought the process wasn't right. The Democratic Party had their process, which I'm a leader in, and half of the city leaders did not attend that meeting when they gave the so-called unanimous endorsement of him. And I had an issue with how that played out.
Okay. It's interesting, as you say, you have a good relationship with Joe Morelli. You have a very, from my understanding, a very good relationship with Mayor Warren.
That's
yes,
right.
And in that way, in this community, you're kind of a bridge builder, because the public sort of sees these factions within the Democratic Party, fairly or not. Mm-hmm. You're someone who has, I think, worked across what those perceived factions might
be. For years.
For years. And there was a lot of assumption that Mayor Warren herself might run for this congressional seat. You know her pretty well. Is that mm-hmm. something that you think she can say?
Well, I asked her, and when she told me she wasn't interested in doing it, that kind of planted the seed a little bit for me, mm-hmm. But it wasn't the deciding factor. But I thought she would have been a great candidate for the seat. I thought the deputy mayor would have been a great candidate for this race as well.
And yeah, I don't want to dwell too much on this, but the Democrat and Chronicle had this great picture of you, your announcement of running for, at Brew Coffee, right?
That's right.
On Genesee Street.
That's right.
You announced in a very, very different setting. Now, you had a bunch of supporters there, but it was essentially just you and who was on stage with you?
My brother.
Just you and your brother.
Yes.
And it wasn't this show of sort of party backing.
No.
Whereas Joe Morelli announced with, you know, what looked like dozens of well-known elected leaders, including Mayor Warren. And mm-hmm. I wonder why some folks like Loretta Scott, Mayor Warren, knowing that decisions had to be made quickly within days here because the primary was going to be coming pretty quickly. But why not wait until they see everybody who's running? Did you feel disappointed that they didn't support you, that they're supporting Joe Morelli?
Not at all. I understand the timing and why they did what they did. And again, I had not announced. I hadn't told anybody what I was going to do. That happened before I made my decision. And like I've said to you off the air, the mayor is my sister and my friend, and I will continue to back her. And the way I look at that is she could get something out of Joe Morelli if he wins. She can. But if I win, she could get something much greater. Because if you look at the differences between the two, I've always supported her.
Joe hasn't, you don't think?
I would just say go back and check the news articles. And that's not to say that he would not in the future, but everybody knows the history inside the Democratic Party about who supported who. And so I kind of look at that and say she made a decision based on a set of facts that she had at the time. And I can't blame Joe for going to her wanting to, you know, build the bridge back so that the party could come together. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Okay, but do you think if you announced on the same day as Joe Morelli, the mayor would have supported you?
I think that would have been very tough for her.
Okay, fair enough. Now, do you agree with the public assessment that the Democratic Party locally has been fractured?
It's always been fractured. The issue has been most people have never known that it was fractured this badly, but I've been involved with the Democratic Party here locally since 1994. So for me, I've always seen the fracture. I came out of a process where I didn't get the support of black leadership at the time. I ran as an outsider for city council. I ran against the deceased Willie Lightfoot. I ran against Bill Johnson and David Gantz candidate at that time. So we've always kind of been different, you know, in terms of who we supported and not all being on the same page. But that's what makes Democrats great, because at least we have dialogue about who should be in leadership versus just anointing one person and putting them out there.
Fair enough. And as you say, you know, when you ran, you didn't necessarily get support from black leadership. And this is why I'm a little surprised at this state in the congressional race, this very short primary that you're involved in, that I figured at least the Congressional Black Caucus has two African-American candidates that they could decide to support if they wanted to. My understanding is that they are supporting Joe Morelli. Is that right?
The PAC.
Thank you for helping
yes,
explain
the
this.
The PAC. And the PAC is, and we can talk about this. The PAC is ran by Greg Meeks, who served in the assembly with Joe Morelli. And it's my understanding that when Joe called, he conveyed to them that there were no African Americans in the race. That's what I'm being told. Now, when he called, I don't know. I don't know how that all happened. I do know that I have caucus members trying to get involved with this to make this right. Because actually, when you think about the black community here in Rochester and you compare my record to his, it's not even a contest.
Are you offended that the Congressional Black
Extremely. Extremely. I work with them. I was the president of the National Black Caucus of local elected officials, were considered the big brother organization of theirs. I was the president at the time that Marsha Fudge was the president. We worked together. We sat on a National Policy Alliance together, had an office in D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. I met with them regularly, so I know the members.
And they're supporting a candidate who's—
The PAC.
The PAC is, okay.
Which is led by one person.
Okay.
There are members on the PAC, but the decision was made by the person that runs it. So he can say I'm supported by the CBC. It's the PAC, which is not the membership of the CBC. It's a few people, but it's ran by someone he served with on the assembly.
Okay. And one more question on this, and then we're going to turn to issues the rest of the hour with Adam McFadden. You can read more about Adam at McFaddenForCongress.com. That's a website. And again, June 26th is the primary day. I ask about these issues, and I will tell our listeners, Joe Morelli will be on this program before the end of this month, because I suspect that Joe Morelli would put his own record in serving the black community up there.
That's a joke. That's a joke. And he and I talked about that. So I would hope that he would not do that. We talked about why that record is not where it should be. We've had that conversation.
Does he agree with you?
He told me why. He brought it up. I didn't bring it up. So when we say record, I would challenge that.
Okay, I'm simply saying he'll have a chance to talk about that record on this program later this month.
He will. I would say this. It's not a contest compared to mine. It's not even a discussion that probably should be had.
I think we're going to have all four candidates on this program, or I'm sorry, in a debate on Thursday, June 21st, a Voice of the Voter debate the night of Thursday, the 21st. So I suspect this may come up there, and we don't want to. I want to spend the hour on Adam's issues, but you're very pointed about this. So where's one line of distinction you would say his record, your record, and they differ?
No record versus a record. A record is about legislation. A record is about representation. A record is about advocacy. So you think about, I'll give you an example, education. I sponsor a United Negro College fair every year here in Rochester that delivers over $1 million in resources and scholarships to area students every year. You talk about things that have happened in terms of homicides and drug dealing in black communities. I've been a leader on that. You want to talk about job creation in African-American communities. I made sure that funding went to places that deserved it on Jefferson Avenue and some of our most challenged neighborhoods. There is no record on the other side of that of any of the candidates.
Okay, we're talking to Adam McFadden, who is a member of Rochester City Council and running for Congress. Four candidates in the June 26th primary. And again, you can already listen to the conversations we've had with Robin Wilt, Rachel Barnhart, and later this month we will welcome Joe Morelli, who is running. You grew up in the city of Rochester, graduated from Edison Tech, and I saw in an interview you did, a little sit-down you did with Loretta Scott, mm-hmm. that you said one of your career goals was to be a controller, which is, you know, you got to love wonkiness. You got to love the numbers.
Let me explain that.
Yeah.
When I left to go to college, my first major was political science. And I sat in a classroom, and it was so boring for me because a lot of stuff they were teaching me, I had already known on my own. And I said, I don't want a degree in this. So what would be challenging for me? And I went to see my advisor, and she said, well, our toughest program here right now is probably accounting because they had a professor that was just really tough. And I said, I think I'll change my major to that because I've always liked a challenge. And once I got into it, I said, you know what? I would not mind being a controller. And I remember just, you know, thinking about it so much that I didn't think I would achieve that till I was about 40, 50-ish. And I ended up achieving that at 30. So
software development company?
Yes, that's right. Sophie Tech, that's still around today. Great group of people. They do great work.
And has that helped you in your work in office, in your work in understanding politics?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you're given responsibility, whether it's a controller, executive director, or responsibility for other people, that definitely helps you because when you have to worry about whether or not you can make payroll, whether or not people, you know, people's benefit packages are right, or can we, you know, end the year in the black without, you know, laying off folks. I mean, those things right there hit home when you're living it. It's not about this race. You'll find that as candidates, we all talk about certain things, but we've never experienced them. In my case, I've experienced a lot. And so I come from a perspective that it's not just about the talk, but it's about the action. It's about the responsibility, the fact that you've been put in a situation where people trust you to do these types of things.
Of course, in Washington, you can deficit spend all you want. It's a big difference.
What are we, 24 a trillion right now
in debt?
Yeah. So Yeah, I could help there.
Adam McFadden is our guest for the hour. He is a member of Rochester City Council running for Congress. It's 844-295-TALK if you want to call the program with comments or questions. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You're the executive director of Quad A for Kids. And for the listeners who don't know what that is, tell them what that is.
Quad A for Kids is a youth development organization that specializes in youth programs through after school. So right now we serve about 1,000 kids a day in five sites at 5 days a week, 3 hours a day. We make sure that kids participate in STEM programming, project-based learning, some athletics, arts, a whole bunch of things. For us, it's really about trying to develop our young people so that they will have a cycle of prosperity versus a cycle of poverty.
And now I think it's a good time to start asking you about some of the individual issues that are most important to you and how that corresponds to the work that you've done in four terms on council. You know, you talk about wanting to work on education and job creation. And let's talk about job creation, because you brought that up as one of the points you think distinguishes your record.
Yes.
And, you know, certainly we need more jobs, but how do you view the creation of jobs as a function of government or a function of a public-private set of partnerships? How have you approached that?
I think that it is public-private partnerships. Government alone cannot create jobs. They can create opportunities. And what I found is most of the times when we're talking job creation in Rochester, they're highly skilled technical jobs that we have not prepared our workforce for, so we have to bring people in. That's not helping us in Rochester. What we need is to make sure that our educational system is set up so that we're preparing the next wave of workers to be technically trained to take those jobs. This isn't just about reading and writing anymore. This is about STEM programming and people having an understanding of science, technology, engineering, and math so that they're prepared to work in what I would call this next generation of the workforce. Service jobs are going away. So what are we going to do? Still pray for that they come back? Or are we going to prepare young people to be ready for those opportunities? That's probably the most frustrating thing for me, is to watch these wonderful opportunities come. You had the governor here announcing right down the street at High Falls that, you know, 500 jobs would come here, very technical jobs. Yesterday, there was an announcement made that, 36 jobs were going to be created for photonics. Our schools aren't preparing young people for that. That's why we have to have STEM programming as a number one component to public education, because our young people deserve an opportunity to work in this new job market that's being created. Manufacturing, we relied on so much that we hurt ourselves, and we think it's going to come back. But if it does come back, it's not coming back as we used to know it. It's going to come back with robots. And guess who programmed robots? People in STEM programming.
So that's how you get around automation.
That's right.
You know, automation, it sounds like you think is part of the future, whether we like it or not.
That's right. You look at, you go into McDonald's right now. They have a board that you type in what you want. Somebody goes and cooks it. But it used to be you had to tell a person what you want. Not anymore. They're finding ways to replace people with automation for everything. And that being the case, if we do not prepare our workforce for science, technology, engineering, and math, we're going to continue to have this employment problem. And it won't just be in Rochester, but it will be around the country.
All right, before I grab Dan in Rochester's call, I want to just ask you to kind of take this in two ways. Number one, the work that you've already done on council on this educational issue, and then how that would translate to Washington, because there are some listeners who are going to be hearing this thinking, look, you've been on city council for four terms. How come this hasn't changed?
And I just told you about my college fair that I do every year. Last year, we had 1,300 kids attend a college fair downtown. $1.3 million given out in scholarships for our children to go to these colleges. Many of the scholarships that were given were STEM-focused. So what we do, we bring the colleges in, these historically black colleges in, and we tell them what it is that we're attempting to do. They set themselves up to meet the kids, put them through an interview process. And, you know, for those kids who are prepared to go, they make offers on the spot.
That's a fair. What about day-to-day in schools?
Day-to-day in schools, well, I run an after-school program. Mm-hmm. And so for me, our programs are STEM-focused. So I'll give you an example of one of the great programs we do. We do soapbox derby racing. There's a STEM curriculum that goes with that. Our kids are in elementary school learning physics and don't even know it to participate in the program. So when you talk about weight distribution, wind, drag, how to take advantage of gravity, that's all levels of physics. You're talking about fourth and fifth graders learning physics. So we've done that in those programs. On June 2nd, we'll have more than 100 racers out at Lakeshore Boulevard racing those cars. Last year, Rochester placed the first national STEM champion in my program. They went out to Akron, Ohio, and we came in first and fourth place. It's a program that I developed.
And when it comes to photonics, you mentioned that's just one example of the mm-hmm. kinds of jobs we'll see. That's been a bit of a hot button. The longtime member of Congress, Louise Slaughter, was just one of the vocal supporters of funding at the federal level for this kind of development in Rochester. The cynics are saying, where is it? How do you see the future of photonics in Rochester?
I think they need to do a better job of explaining what they're trying to accomplish. Everything has been, photonics is great and it's here. There's been little detail about what that means, other than probably the people that work in the industry. But for the average person living in Rochester, they can't tell you what the program is about and why it was important to even fund it. And so I think we have to do a better job of explaining that to the public.
All right, let me grab some listener feedback. This is Dan in Rochester. First on with Adam McFadden. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes, this is Dr. Dan DeMarle, resident of Southwest Rochester in the 19th Ward. And, you know, Adam, I was so thrilled when I heard you were running. You know, I coordinate a lot of stuff in the city. And anytime I've ever needed something from Adam, he's been there for me and for my community. A number of years ago, we were having an increase in break-in, and I reached out to Adam and said, Adam, we need to do something. We put together a crime fair. We gave people could come in. They could hear about how to protect their houses. Adam helped arrange that, set up the location. Another time, the city school district was doing something that they shouldn't have been doing. I talked to Adam. Adam went behind the door, went behind the scenes, talked to the board members. You know, Adam's been a real pillar of our community, and I'm thrilled to hear he's pursuing this. And I've got to run into a meeting.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate that. I imagine you do, too.
Yes, I do.
All right, well. Thank you, Dan. And I before I grab our next phone call, are you the kind of person who, have you gotten used to constituent work? I mean, your phone ringing at all hours, is that just part of the job? And would you take that to Washington?
My phone has been ringing since I've been here, sitting on a radio show. So that has never stopped for me. There are a ton of people that have my cell phone number, a ton of people that have my email address. I get calls about things that I can't even fix. So I've been called during the holiday season, and somebody say, "Hey, my pilot light is out. You know, can you come light it?" No stuff.
Did
that
you
I
do
can't.
It?
No, I called someone who deals with gas. That's not my thing. But what I'm good at connecting people to folks who can do whatever it is that needs to be done. If I can't do it, I'm not one of these people that think that I can do everything.
All right, this is Kathy in Rochester next. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi, Adam. It's very exciting to hear some of the things you're working on. As an educator myself in the city school district, it's really important. Mm-hmm. But I have a question. I didn't see you at the meeting last night. I was concerned that there were three people missing on city council at the discussion about what to do with the lowest income housing at Cobbs Hill Park. I was wondering where you stand on that.
The public hearing, there were three dates set, so I picked one of the dates, and yesterday wasn't the date that I picked. So where I stand on that is the city is in need of more low-income housing. We have a real crisis when it comes to this because of housing prices going up in terms of rent rates. Cobbs Hill, I wasn't satisfied with the proposal that I saw in the beginning. I think the developer and landlord there are attempting to meet some of the requirements of some of the things were asked by the public and council members. For me right now, I've always taken the opinion of things not in my district that it isn't really my choice or decision to make, that it would be the district council person's decision. I try not to go in other people's neighborhood and decide for them what's important. Just like
of course, in this case, this is not a neighborhood concern. This is the lowest income housing that will be lost in the city. There's a crisis with the Cadillac Hotel closing as well. And not only that, it's a park that's not for a neighborhood. It's a park for the city. People come from all over the city to play ball, to be there. It should be a concern for all of us.
I'm not saying it's not a concern. I take the lead from the district council member that's there. But I'll say this. The landlord, from my understanding, has said that the 60 low-income houses that are there now, that those rates would stay with the tenants.
They'd freeze.
Yes, if they moved over to the new building. And I think that's a huge movement to have someone willing to put that in place so that they don't lose the low-income housing in terms of numbers that they have currently. But I still haven't made a decision about where I'm going to – I'm torn on it.
All right, Kathy, thank you. This is Marianne in Rochester next. I'm with Adam McFadden, who's running for Congress. Go ahead, Marianne.
Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Hi. I have a question about how you're going to be able to translate what you do for the city to the suburbs.
For me, that's very easy for me. This is about people. This isn't about imaginary lines. So when I get a call from a constituent, a lot of times I have people who call me not in my district, and depending on the issue, I will still try to help them. For me, this is about being accessible to people no matter where they live or how much money they have or what color their skin is. We have to balance whatever our personal beliefs are with the people's belief, meaning my campaign is about putting the people first, so it doesn't matter where they live. It doesn't matter how much money you make. It doesn't matter what title you may have or, you know, what religion you are. If you call me and you have an issue, I'll deal with it.
Marianne, that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to call, Marianne. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. We're 263-WXXI here in Rochester, 263-9994. Got a couple of emails who are hearing this program and are expressing some surprise that Mayor Warren did not endorse you. And again, if you missed that earlier, Adam explained that the mayor made her endorsement and stood with Joe Morelli really before you were in the race.
That's right.
By a couple of days. They're wondering if that is related to Parcel 5. Essentially, they're saying, look, Joe Morelli came out and said that the city should not be asking the state for millions of dollars for Parcel 5 and the Performing Arts Center project there. And they're wondering now, okay, the mayor stands with Joe Morelli, and now Morelli will sort of pave the way for state help.
I can't speak on behalf of the mayor. I didn't have a conversation about Parcel 5 with her. I had a conversation about why I was running.
Do you think that's related at all?
I have no clue. It's the first time anyone's posed that to me.
Thought about it?
Actually, no. You know what I thought about was who was in the race at the time that he asked.
Okay. And you were not.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And Gary writes to us and says, this morning on NPR, there was a story about Democrats potentially supporting a guaranteed employment plan. Would a Congressman McFadden support that?
I don't know enough about that to comment. I would have to see the details. I do think that at some point this country is going to have to look at what I would say some type of universal income to keep up with automation. We just can't. There are not enough jobs to go around for the population of people we have.
If you missed it on a previous program, no other than Elon Musk made a very similar comment that automation may be so ingrained in the future of our manufacturing that a UBI, a universal basic income, might be necessary. Again, that was Elon Musk saying that. And so it's not just sort of a Democrat versus a Republican idea. It's going to be interesting to see just how much that debate develops in Washington. When we come back after our only break here, we'll ask Adam McFadden, if he becomes Congressman McFadden, where he stands on a federal minimum wage, where he stands on single-payer health care and health care systems, and what you'd like to do in Washington about that. We'll talk more about job development and what he thinks Washington can do better, if you think Washington can do better, for our region and this district when it comes to jobs. It's McFaddenforCongress.com. He's one of four candidates running, and this is our interview with Adam this hour. We're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a new coalition of neighborhood groups is putting together their list of what they might call five demands when it comes to development and housing projects. They want to see permanent affordable housing and sustainability. So how could you make affordable housing permanent? How do you prevent gentrification? What are the right kinds of development and projects? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Adam McFadden running for Congress. And if you go to Washington, you will support a minimum wage at what level? You want to see it change at the federal level?
Oh, yeah. I'm a supporter of the fight for 15. So that's what I would like to see.
Okay. When it comes to health care, are you an advocate for single payer or any other system?
I've always been an advocate for single payer. I probably know more about this than most people. I've actually studied this issue. I look at places that have universal health care like Japan and the Netherlands. A lot of people talk about Canada, but if you look at Japan and the Netherlands and their what I would say is, you know, how long the people live, that's the indicator to me they have the, you know, longest life expectancy. And so that tells me their health care system is doing very well.
That's interesting, relating it in that fashion. And and I think given your background, again, Adam was majoring in accounting and served as a controller and likes to get a little wonky with the numbers. So when people talk about paying for single payer, that's probably its own monstrous study that has to happen in the future based on how the proposal would lay out.
It's not as bad as people think.
You don't think so?
The healthcare savings that would happen for people individually, they'd probably be willing to pay the extra taxes to make it happen. So I'll give you an example. If you're paying $500 a month for healthcare right now in a company-sponsored plan and your payment went to $100 a month for taxes to pay for it, wouldn't you take that?
Well, if it's that simple.
I'm just saying. That's, in my mind, how simple it could be if the Republicans and Democrats were willing to really talk about the truth around single payer healthcare systems and universal healthcare. If they had a real discussion about it and looked at the fact that we pay the highest amount of costs as a country, but have the lowest, what I would say, quality of care of all of the industrialized nations that are currently, what is 30 of them, in universal healthcare. So how is it that we're paying more but get less?
Well, what you're suggesting is that Democrats and Republicans in Washington will work together on this.
If they really were about fixing issues, they would. I have a history of working with people I don't like. And meaning, if there's an issue that has to get done for the, I would say, the betterment of my district or community, and me and you were not favorable to each other, I still would talk to you and say, hey, we got to get this done. Let's do it.
I don't do this to sort of stir the pot and ask you to name names. I'm not asking you to name names, but I think that ability to compromise and get things done would be important in Washington. So can you point to an example or two of where you've said, hey, I worked, you know, on this issue, even though it wasn't easy?
Oh, I can give you two of them off the top of my head. Ban the box. When I first put that out there, all of my colleagues said no. They didn't want to take it on. They didn't know how we would do it. And I said, this is important to our community. It's happening in other communities. It's happened in some states. So we need to get this done. And they weren't budging on it. And I went to the University of Rochester, their president, Joel, and said, hey, what do you think about this? And he said, you know what? I'll do you one better. I'll send you a support letter and we'll, you know, put this in our own system to make this the rule. And when I came back with that letter and they saw our biggest employer had agreed to do it, all of my colleagues said, you know what? It's not a bad idea. The other one was source of income discrimination. Had no votes for it when I started out on the issue. I started out on that issue back in 2014. It took me 3 years to work around and get a unanimous vote, but I got it.
Two examples that Adam is sharing and his thoughts on the compromise work that has to happen in Washington. He is one of four Democrats running for Congress on the ballot June 26th. Let me grab another phone call. This is Noel in Rochester. Go ahead, Noel.
Hey there.
Hello.
I would like to remind, hi, Mr. McFadden. I'd like to remind you that correlation is not causation. And diet and nutrition are probably much more stronger indicators of health and long life.
I would agree with that.
If the Japanese ate like we do, they'd be dying at the same rate.
They have McDonald's now.
They do.
Unfortunately, yeah, that may have an effect. You're absolutely right.
Noel, thank you. I take his point there, but
I agree with his point. I think that comes with public education. That comes with a stronger Food and Drug Administration. Even when you go out of the country, if you had the privilege to go any place in Europe and you get a burger from McDonald's there, you see and taste the difference. Why is that? Because they don't allow some of the preservatives and additives that we put in stuff.
I want to shift the conversation to a direction that you've done a lot of work in this area, and I think there are debates happening on the federal level with this, and it's complex. It starts, I think, with the discrimination and sort of the, you know, our history of racism in this country that has created systems mm-hmm. in which it is more difficult for some citizens than others to work. Mm-hmm. Some of that is sort of borne out in implicit bias from the very basic but sort of pernicious stuff that we saw, you know, two women who are leaving an Airbnb in a largely white neighborhood and, you know, white people calling
police on them.
You know, and all of a sudden there's a helicopter flying overhead. The two people in the Philadelphia Starbucks. I mean, unfortunately, the five black women on a golf course for playing too slowly.
Most of us in the black community have experienced some form of that.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I don't discount that. What I'm saying is those examples are just one example of how just day-to-day life can be more difficult and for people of color in so-called quote-unquote white spaces or perceived to be white spaces. But I'm also wondering if there's policy, if there's work that Washington can do. Is it cultural work? Let's start there.
I think there's some work that they can do in terms of making some actions illegal in terms of how people conduct themselves. So if you falsely call the police on somebody that's an innocent person, there should be something that happens to the person that called. I do kind of look at things like what happened, you know, when you look at Eric Gardner and things like that. I actually wrote, as the president of the National Black Caucus, a letter to the federal government and to the heads of state attorney general offices asking for the state attorney general to do the investigations whenever there was a police-involved death. That way, there would be no bias between the district attorney's office and the police department. So there are things that can actually happen. So right now in Rochester, if there was a crime committed or an alleged crime committed by a police officer, it would be the Monroe County DA's office that would prosecute that. And some people would say that's too much of a conflict of interest because of the relationship between the DA's office and the police department. But it's not that relationship between the state attorney general's office and the police department.
Okay.
So there are things that can be done to kind of break these things up.
When you talk about if someone falsely calls police on someone who hasn't done anything wrong, and I'll take the example of, I think, two women who police were called to a neighborhood because there was a suspicion that they were breaking into a house that just happened to be an Airbnb where they were staying.
Yes.
And so let's say I'm the white person who makes that phone call. And what should the ramifications be for me?
I can't talk about what I think they should be until I know what was on that person's mind. But I would say this, at the very least, there probably should be some community service around, you know, race relations or some type of training to say, hey, not all black people are breaking in houses. I think we have to be practical. I'm not saying you lock people up, but you force them to go through some type of, you know, training that would teach them. You know, you can't just look at someone's skin color and pretend all of a sudden that makes them a criminal.
And just playing devil's advocate, I suspect some listeners would say, but hey, that would make some people less likely to call police if they are suspicious of something that might turn out to be a real problem or threat.
I understand the problem with that. We have that problem now where people don't want to call the police because when they see stuff, the police come knock on their door in front of the criminal act. So for me, this is about people checking their action to say, okay, am I really seeing a criminal activity or am I just seeing people because of their skin color? Like the golf course. To me, that's not a criminal act, that playing golf too slow.
White people are very capable of playing slow golf.
Most of us are very. I play golf, so most of us are capable of that. Depending on what we have in our golf cart.
Usually, the police are not called.
No.
Yeah.
They just tell you, the people behind you tell you to speed up. You know, that's it.
You've done work on income discrimination and housing, things like that. Is there work to be done on the federal level there?
It's state level.
That's the state level.
Yes, I think the states could do more. With that, even though the federal government already makes it illegal to do that. Most people don't know that. That when you look at like the voucher system, mm-hmm. Section 8, you cannot discriminate on that voucher. Most people don't know that that law exists already. So the federal government doesn't have any work to do. We just have enforcement work to do.
And I don't mean to be... I'm just making an observation. I'm curious to know if you agree. That enforcement work that comes from already existing federal law, I may wonder if that's less likely to be enforced, considering that the President of the United States has engaged in housing discrimination.
That's right. I would agree with you there. And then he has a Secretary of HUD who doesn't know anything about housing. I don't see that happening, but there is work to be done.
Okay. And listeners who may be supporters of this president, I'm just observing what we know to be true.
Absolutely.
Donald Trump and his father discriminated against people of color. Yes. I mean, and that goes back to the 1970s. Shane on Twitter wants to know, is the city enforcing the Section 8 discrimination bill that you helped to pass in June?
The state attorney general's office is the enforcement arm of that.
Okay. Shane wants to know, do you know if it's having a positive effect?
That I don't know. I know some of it was still occurring. And what I do when I find out that it's happening, I send a letter personally to say, hey, the law has changed. You can no longer do that. Just as a warning, because not everybody knew that the law had changed. But the state attorney general's office is the enforcement arm of that.
Okay. When it comes to making sure we've got students who are going through schools here in our area who are prepared for a future workforce, you talked about STEM, and we've already heard from some folks on Twitter saying you're on the money there, that focus, they really applaud you for that. What else do you view as a member of Congress, if you're a member of Congress, what else do you view as your role in job creation, and what approach would you take if you go to Washington?
Well, I think about infrastructure. I mean, if you just drive around Rochester between our roads and our bridges, there's a lot to be done. And that's around the country in general. I think we could do a lot better and put more resources into that. That would do what I would call some temporary job creation, but it also is a way to give additional training to people in other types of careers that aren't going anywhere. So we have a whole workforce of things like plumbing, welding, construction. Those fields aren't going anywhere, but it does require some training and some knowledge of it.
I want to ask you a question about guns, and I want to ask it in a way that some might think is a waste of time because it's just a hypothetical, but I think it will be instructive to get a sense for what you'd like to see Congress do. Let's be pie in the sky here. You show up in Washington and they say, Congressman McFadden, we're going to ask you to reshape all of the gun laws. whatever you think we ought to do, we're going to do it.
Well, the first thing I would say, we have to have an assault weapon ban, period. That would be the first thing.
And confiscation or ban going forward?
Ban going forward.
Okay.
And the reason why I say going forward is if you bought a gun under the law, which allowed you to have it and you've already paid for it, for me, I'm not one of these people that say, okay, we're going to make everybody give up what they have. We're not going to get – most people are not going to turn that in. But I do think going forward, there's a way to do that. I also think that we can do things like, you know, we've done in the state in terms of capacity of the magazine rounds that go with those guns. So you could make that go backwards. So you can't put 30 rounds into a clip. You can only put 9. You know, you do that type of thing. I also think that, you know, because of the Constitution and our right to bear arms, I own a shotgun in my house. My family in South Carolina is a hunting family. Rifles are not, you know, one of those things that are what I would say scarce in my family. Shotguns is one of those things that's not scarce in my family. So I understand the willingness and the need for people to feel like they need to protect their homes. I get it because I do it. So I'm not one of these people that say we got to get rid of all guns and people shouldn't have them. But I am saying, we don't need assault weapons. And I got to think that police departments would say we don't need assault weapons because the people who have assault weapons could be potentially using it on our law enforcement officers.
Okay. Any other changes you'd make to gun law or related issues?
I definitely around mental health checks. I think that is big. I don't know why the current president wouldn't support that. That seems like a gimme that we would make sure that people were mentally stable before buying weapons. I have a huge issue with that. And I do think that we have to do something around securing weapons, too. Children should not have access to our weapons.
All right. Let me grab Andrew in Irondequoit next on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, Adam. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, really force people to take classes? Do you really want to go down that road? Do you want to? I don't get it.
Let me explain it this way. If you've never had this happen to you, you probably would not understand it. But I've had it happen to me throughout my lifetime. I can explain it. And one day I was playing basketball in Gates. You might remember the old Wegmans that was on Chilai Avenue in Brooks. I go in there for a Gatorade with three friends. My one friend had just bought a brand new Ford Escort. This is, you know, in the 90s. We come out. We have a police officer tail us. He pulls us over. Makes us all get out of the car, checks our ID. We've done nothing. And when he couldn't find anything, what he said to us, if he caught us in Gates again, he would blow our heads off.
Okay.
So if you've never had that experience, you probably wouldn't understand why I'd say we would have to do something. But,
right.
But that's something I've lived with. And right. I've had numerous, as a young man, now I'm recognizable. I don't really have a lot of that. But in my late teens, in my mid-20s, I went through a lot of that where, just being somewhere that people thought you weren't supposed to be could be
right.
a problem.
Yeah, no, I've had that happen to me, too, believe it or not.
Okay.
Just being a white guy, but in the wrong, you know, sitting in a truck waiting for another contractor to come help me on a job in a nice suburbs, you know, some people called up and said, hey, who's that guy? Suspicious guy, you know. That's
But
that
not
happens.
Because you're white, right,
no,
Andrew?
No.
Okay,
well,
so you're not, you cannot relate to Adam on this, right?
Well, wait a minute. If somebody's I mean, I don't see where. What about the bigger part of it being just somebody hanging around the neighborhood that, what is this guy doing here? Whether he's white or black.
We live in a free country.
Okay.
I'm not saying, I don't want you confused what I'm saying.
I mean, if someone go out and hang out on a really expensive street in Brighton, people might call up and say, who's that guy?
Nobody is going to call.
It's happened to me before.
Now, if you're walking in someone's yard, if you were walking in someone's yard, scoping out someone's house, I could understand that. But just sitting there, I don't think that would happen.
What is all that neighborhood watch stuff about? What were you watching for?
Crime.
Okay, see what I'm saying? But see where I'm going there?
Hanging out is not crime.
Okay, I get that. I mean, yeah.
Anyway. And I understand your struggle with it because for people who really don't experience it to the level that I have experienced it, they don't get it. But
no,
what I'm
saying. I agree with you. I agree with you.
Okay.
I just, you know, forcing people to take class. What if people believe in capitalism?
It's not that. What
I
I'm
saying. Where are we going with this? Are we going to start forcing people to.
Think of it this way. The harm and hurt that it causes to the person that the police is called on. We walk around with those scars. On the funny thing is on the 21st, I think the 21st of June, I'm invited to be the last commencement speaker for the sixth grade at School 41 because the school is closing. What most people don't know is I was bused to School 41 in fifth grade. And in the sixth grade, I got the worst teacher ever. She was a throwback racist to, you know, a time where she probably thought blacks shouldn't be in the school. And I can remember constantly being told I wouldn't amount to anything. And even on my sixth grade report card, I'll never forget this, being embarrassed because I did pretty good in my classes. But in the comment section, she said that Adam lacked the social skills to ever amount to anything in life. She wrote that in my sixth grade report card. Those are the types of experiences. Could you imagine somebody doing that to your child? I was so embarrassed, I scratched it out before I showed my mother my report card.
Nice to know they were wrong.
Absolutely. And it's going to feel good to go back to that school and do that. And I know she's in her grave turning over. And I love the idea of that.
And I'll just say to Andrew, thanks for calling and thanks for at least engaging and listening, because I know you come with a different point of view here, but I appreciate that. Real quick, Adam, because we're going to lose the hour. Rachel just wants to know, Louise Slaughter was a great champion for women and women's reproductive rights. Would you be the same?
Absolutely.
Would you like to fund Planned Parenthood?
Absolutely. I have three daughters. I'm the only guy in the house, so absolutely would support that.
And funding for Planned Parenthood as well?
Absolutely.
That's what Rachel's asking. Rachel and many others, thanks for the emails. Adam McFadden is running for Congress, and it is McFaddenForCongress.com. Longtime member of Rochester City Council. You will see him as part of the Democratic primary debate on WXXI-TV on Thursday, June 21st. And if he's in Congress, I just hope you'll keep coming back here as you always have.
Oh, absolutely. I'm accessible, so it's not a problem for me.
Thank you, Adam. Nice seeing you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.